permitting, at the end of this discussion, talk about the Framework 42 lawsuit as well. I ask that this agenda item be put on for the council to discuss the interim role and to see what, as a body, we'd like to comment on during the public comment period. I believe that period ends on the 17th of February, so this is an opportunity for the council to formulate an opinion or a position. This is not a public hearing, so at my discretion, I may or may not go to the audience for comment. This is for the council to work on this issue. I'll turn it over to Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Behind tab number 3, document number 7 is an overview of the measures that are in the interim rule. Obviously, this is going to be our discussion item. The committee spent some time at its last meeting on the 17th of the 29th of January, and our discussion led to a motion, which I will present shortly on behalf of the committee, and I wanted to put that on the table as a discussion item. The general discussion that we had at the committee level was that there was so much to be fixed in the interim rule that we, quite frankly, didn't have time to address all of it. So the committee made a motion to, which I will put up at this point in time, on behalf of the committee. The committee recommends the council reinforce its recommendation for the interim rule and ask that the National Marine Fisheries Service give further consideration to its recommendation. Those are outlined in the it was just pointed out to me that document number 13 is outlines the management measures that we had requested back in September of the service.
Yes, it was a committee motion.
Okay, so this is a committee motion. As Rick pointed out, the committee didn't have a lot of time because busy doing their work on Amendment 16, which is something we have a lot of control over still. It's our plan. We're developing it. And we'll get into that later today. It'll occupy the rest of our time today. So anyone on the committee wish to share any of their thoughts or why they supported this at the committee level? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The discussion actually began with the consideration of some of the iniquities that the unintended results of the interim rule. And we began a discussion of that actually with the a number of underwater situations. The one we started with was the one that I brought up about the situation with the monk fishermen south of New England. And just as an example, one of the fishermen down there has two boats, monkfish boats, one with an A permit, one with a CD permit, and he'll be in the position of not fishing for groundfish but unable to use one of his boats because he won't have access to a groundfish day at sea in order to deploy his monkfish nets, which don't catch groundfish anyway. So we started a discussion of that, and then Jim Odlin brought up the point that if we got going on that kind of a discussion, as important as it is, that we would be there for 2 or 3 days without ever leaving our seats, because there are so many examples available of that kind of thing. And that's how we finally arrived at the position that this motion states. We just didn't see any way that we could successfully address the interim action on a case-by-case basis or in any way that that we could really have any logical input, and that's how we wound up where we did. Thank you.
Anyone else on the committee or the council? Sally.
Yeah, just a question. I'm having a hard time finding where this motion was in the meeting documents. Was this in, is this in document 15, the meeting summary from January 29th? And I understand that it's referring to the letter that the council submitted back in September, just after the vote on what to recommend to the to National Marine Fisheries with regard to the interim rule, but I'm not finding this motion, and I just need some help orienting to that. Thanks.
I think it's on the second to last page, Sally, under other business. The committee recommends the council reinforce its recommendation for the interim rule and ask that the service give further consideration to its recommendation. Motion made by Mr. Odlin, seconded by Mr. Leary.
Okay. Can I comment on it then? Thank you. So I was unfortunately not present for this discussion. The debate that the council had back in September, as everybody will remember, was very much on the fly in trying to come up with something when it became clear that Amendment 16 was not going to be able to be implemented in time for May 1st, 2010. I don't see what this gets us. I didn't see what it got us back in September. And I understand some of the concerns with the impact of the interim rule in southern New England, but in terms of giving some kind of workable advice to National Marine Fisheries Service about how to effectively respond to the stock assessments from last summer, on some of the stocks, the trip limits that were recommended by the council are inconsistent with what the GARM was telling us we needed to do to rebuild some of those stocks. So for that reason, I can't support reiterating what was said back in September, because it didn't make sense then and it doesn't make sense now. The science hasn't changed on those stocks that are in really bad shape, and I don't see how we can in good faith say that we should be allowing or encouraging the landing of stocks that are in as bad shape as they are.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, the motion is up on the board. The committee decided to ask the service to give further consideration to its recommendation. I suspect that's not going to happen because of what the service has already stated in comments that they've made relative to the interim action that we had requested. So it would seem very unlikely that the service would change its views. I think perhaps it would be helpful in the context of this motion to ask some questions about the interim rule and to ask the service to provide some further explanation as to why they are proposing some of these measures, why they are, for example, going to close down. This is the preferred alternative, so I assume that it's likely the preferred alternative will be adopted after the comment period. Maybe not, the service does change its mind often in response to thoughtful requests backed up by information. And so it would be helpful to me, and I think helpful to this council, if we could get a better explanation, because I don't think it's that well described in either the EA or the proposed rule itself, a better explanation as to why the service is not concerned about the effort shift that would happen with one of the centerpieces of its proposed rule, a centerpiece that is offered up primarily to reduce fishing mortality on southern New England winter flounder, and that is the southern New England closed area, where, except for hook fishing, a very, very large area of southern New England, all the way to the Nantucket Shoals area, between the Nantucket Lightship area, closed area one, that's going to be closed to dragging, certainly, to netting for groundfish. That's a huge step to take. I understand, again, why they're proposing to take it. It's about winter flounder. But as I read it, as I've drawn the conclusion that that will result in a significant effort shift into the Gulf of Maine. And that could therefore result in the undoing of many of the positive things that have happened with our own council regulations to constrain mortality on stocks within the Gulf of Maine, Cape Cod Yellowtail and the rest, Gulf of Maine Cod and the rest. So I'd appreciate some further elaboration regarding that, as well as why the service is not concerned about application of a 2-to-1 day at sea count throughout the entire Gulf of Maine, including the northern edge of Georgia's Bank, with a 2-to-1 day at sea count that widespread. It would seem to me that that would then provide no incentive for fishermen, certainly offshore fishermen, to go to those areas where the count is 1-to-1 so they can preserve their days at sea. They'll likely fish closer to shore if it's 2-to-1 everywhere. There's no longer any incentive to move farther away. So I'm concerned about the increased pressure, fishing pressure, that likely would be brought about from the southern New England closure area, from the 2-to-1 day at sea count applied everywhere, including the northern edge of Georgia's Bank. I'm also wondering if the service has given any thought to the impact of that effort shift in the Stellwagen Bank Marine Sanctuary. That's got to be a concern, certainly within NOAA. Furthermore, as part of my concern about this effort shift, I see that the service is going to, or proposing to, remove the days at sea cap on leasing. Looking at the EA and other documents, I'm not convinced that enough thought has been given to the consequence of that, once again, of effort shifts into the Gulf of Maine. So I'm concerned about that, and I would really appreciate some further discussion, elaboration by the service as to why this council need not be concerned about that which would seem to be a logical outcome of the interim action.
Well, of course, we're in rulemaking, so I can give you the background information but not get into any kind of debate with you on the issues. I think we did provide a good explanation for why we chose this path. We were looking to, at the very least, address the overfishing issues for the 13 stocks that were identified as overfished in the GARM. We were able to do that with the exception of one stock. And on another stock, we chose not to go all the way to effort build, but instead stated FMSY. And so for those two, Northern Windowpane and Georgia's Bank Cod, we did, in fact, not go as far as the council would have had to have gone in Amendment 16 if they had done Amendment 16 for May 1, 2009, in part to mitigate the overall impacts. We modeled the options that are included in the interim action after the options that the council is considering in Amendment 16 to try to be as consistent as we could with what they are proposing, at least for the common pool vessels. And as far as the preferred alternative, in fact, we did use the CAMS model, which I think, as you know, does look at shifts in effort and estimates the impacts through a consideration of both the biological and economic impacts on the fishery, and so would have taken into account the potential for shifts in effort to the Gulf of Maine. We do feel that was part of the analysis that was included in the interim action. There are two other alternatives analyzed in the document, and certainly be curious to hear whether the council thinks one of those is preferable to the one that we've identified as a preferred alternative.
Rip. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My learned colleague from the Commonwealth asked a number of the questions that I was going to ask. I wanted to just bring that up because, at least from the discussions that I've had with people in the industry, that's one of the effort shift has been one of the greatest concerns, and it seems to be echoed in every comment that I've gotten on the interim rule. I also wanted to say that I concur with Sally's comments on this. I think that at the time that we made our comments on the interim rule, it was essentially 12:05. We didn't have a great deal of time to put up extensive thought or any time to do any analysis on the comments that we made. And so I'm not sure that reiterating them does a whole lot. I want to continue to listen to the services' thoughts and comments on why they picked what they did. So anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Rodney.
I have some of the same concerns, but my concern is that the effort shift is not going to go to Gulf of Maine. My concern is the 45 to 65-foot vessel from Long Island, Point Judith, Connecticut, that traditionally fish smooth bottom without the gear capable of fishing in the Gulf of Maine, moving out to Georgia's Banks. You're going to move that vessel 18 to 28 miles away from its home port. These fishermen are not traditionally fishing out there. You're going to put them into a new area where they're not fishing. The weather gets very violent out there. And you're going to put them at a safety risk. That's my concern about this whole thing. They clearly have no place to go other than the Gulf of Maine that puts them into any access that is coastal port if there's a breeze. Just put ourselves in a 40-year-old boat that's 60 foot long out in the Gulf of Maine, and we've got 20 hours to get to any safe refuge when a storm comes up. That's my biggest concern about this. Thank you.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I mean, I share all the previous speakers' concerns. When I read this interim action, the first response I had was a deep sense of disappointment for the fish. I have a deep sense of disappointment for the fishermen as well, but it was primarily for the fish. I was just stunned. I mean, I would rename this the Gulf of Maine Cod Extermination Act because that's what it is. And it's going to exterminate fish in southern New England as well. I mean, you can still fish for fluke there. You can still fish for monkfish. That's groundfish gear. I don't care what you call it. What's going to happen to all those yellowtails and blackbacks that are caught while the same thing is going on? They're going to get shoveled over the side. So it's the Southern New England Blackback and Yellowtail Extermination Act. I support the motion as written. I, you know, maybe the trip limits need to be modified, but you know, we need to keep boats working in the areas they're currently working. That means offshore boats in the offshore area, southern New England boats in the southern New England area, and Gulf of Maine boats in the Gulf of Maine area. You know, this is going to lead to serial depletion of our stocks. You know, we finally have got some rebuilding in the Gulf of Maine after we sent all the boats from Georgia's there 15 years ago. You're going to do the same thing all over again. I mean, this is just stunning to me. This is just terrible. You know, I care about these fish. I want to have fish around for the future. I don't want to be back here 2 years from now saying, okay, we got to shut the Gulf of Maine down because everybody moved there and exterminated the Gulf of Maine cod. Or as Rodney says, some of them will go to Georgia's Bank. I guess we won't really have to worry about what they exterminate because they're going to exterminate themselves. They're going to drown on Georgia's Bank. You don't send 45 to 60-foot boats 100 miles offshore, not if you want them to come back. You know, that's a one-way ticket. And so I really was stunned. I mean, I was just terribly discouraged. I think, you know, the council's action may not have been perfect, but crafted with you know, an hour's thought after receiving a stock assessment, it's certainly no worse than this. I personally think it's a lot better. You know, again, maybe we need to adjust the trip limits a little bit. But if you put this in as written, what's going to be left of the fishermen and the fish is going to be, you know, it's going to be incredibly discouraging on both fronts. And you're not going to have solved your problem one bit. So I hope that you'll seriously reconsider this action.
Jim Alden.
Difficult to decide where to start on this. I guess I'll start out with math. An 18.2% cut in days and 2-for-1 counting is a 59% cut, not a 36% cut, as your document states. So I don't know how you did the analysis, but it appears to me you did it using a 36% cut and not a 59% cut. So that's a significant problem. Because you're trying to say that groundfish boats would have an estimated drop in revenue of 31% with a 59% cut in their time at sea. I can't see how that can be. The price isn't going to make up for that. That's for darn sure. So that's some difficulty there. I don't understand why you would have 2-to-1 counting in eastern Georgia's at all when it's, those stocks are under hard TAC. I don't understand why in the southern New England area you didn't give consideration to a restricted gear area versus a complete closure. There's a lot of revenue generated in that area from other fish, that haddock, for instance, and lots of others that could be accomplished with a restricted gear area. Let's see, what else did I have? So I think, and I think you went further than necessary in an interim rule, and I think that if we start down the road, we're going to have to go item for item here and start making adjustments if that's what the council ends up wanting to do. So I just give them my input on what I think of the plan as it exists, and then if this particular motion fails, then I think we'd have to go back and start picking up each piece here and try to make adjustments to it and then submit something. But I don't think we can make this proposed rule, tweaking the edges, anything that's reasonable and anything that will not have a negative impact on the stocks themselves. And I agree with Dave Gaethel. That's the first thing I said, was I can't see anything more devastating to the stocks than this proposed rule. Thank you.
Pat.
Just quickly on the first point, there was an error in the preamble to the proposed rule on the percentage, the maximum percentage reduction. I can't remember, 36 or 38%, should have been 59%. It is correct in the environmental assessment, and the analysis wasn't based on those percentages either.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just a couple of other points. Pat mentioned the closed area model, and obviously we use the closed area model, have for quite a long time, to try to determine the consequences of different options. that are out there for dealing with mortality reductions and rebuilding stocks that are in need of rebuilding. But I would call the council's attention and Pat's attention, if you haven't noticed it, Pat, I'm sure you have. On page 303 of the EA, section 13.1.2, there's a very important statement made about the closed area model, and I think we all should reflect on it because it's not a wake-up call, but just a reminder as to the limitations of the closed area model in terms of how predictive it is. You know, we make a lot of very important decisions based on that closed area model. And there's one short section here that I'd like to read because it's very relevant to this motion and to other discussions perhaps we'll have later on groundfish. And it says, it should be noted, as was in the case of Amendment 13, that the model is a simulation of behavioral responses to changes in fishery regulations, and the results should be interpreted as broad indicators of relative changes rather than as precise predictions of mortality impacts. Small percent changes, for example, should be viewed as less likely relative outcomes than large percent changes. Because many of the stocks are caught in the same areas, often the management options will return larger reductions in exploitation for one species in order to achieve the reductions necessary for another species. Estimated reductions that are larger than necessary are likely to be less risky in terms of not meeting mortality targets. And that's really what it's all about. It's a question of being precautionary and trying to be less risky. We really don't know what that means, less risky. But nevertheless, that's the whole concept. That's what's behind the CAM. And be it Amendment 13 or Framework 42 or this interim action, there is such a tremendous loss in optimum yield with the choices that we have to consider. And in this particular case, with the preferred option, Table 127, makes the case. Once again, a tremendous amount of yield is lost from those stocks that can sustain moderate amounts of fishing pressure. And I'll make one other point, and it's with regard to the target reductions in exploitation. Clearly, when we see a table that says you've got to reduce your exploitation by 34% or 50% or whatever, it raises all sorts of red flags, and we say, that's a problem. That really needs to be addressed, but let me highlight one example of how we have to take this in the proper context, and that's with Southern New England Yellowtail. Southern New England Yellowtail needs a 36% reduction. That's the target reduction in exploitation, as described in the document. We're going to achieve, according to the CAM, about an 85% reduction, not a 36% reduction, by going with that strategy of the Southern New England closed area, well, the area being closed down except for hook fishing and other elements. But we need to remember that, this council has been quite successful in getting mortality to low levels for quite a few stocks. And I take note of the fact that fishing mortality in 2008, as shown in the report, the EA, was just 0.12, which translates into about 8% exploitation. So 8% exploitation. The target is 0.08, or about 6% exploitation. So when you have to reduce from 8% to 6%, it seems like a big reduction in terms of a percent reduction from 8 to 6, but we're at 8%. We need 6%. I would think that there would be other strategies to be employed that would enable us to get that rather modest reduction in exploitation as opposed to a strategy that's being offered up as a preferred that will shut down the entire Southern New England fishery for groundfish except for hooking, that will likely direct boats into other fisheries, fluke, you named it, others, and we're already dealing with restrictions for those particular fisheries. We don't need any more effort in those fisheries. Where are they going to go? They have to go there. Or they'll go into state waters fisheries, putting more pressure there, forcing me and other states to respond in kind with further restrictions to deal with that possible shift in effort. All sorts of implications here. And we're obviously going to provide some formal comments on the interim rule to assist Pat deal with this very difficult question. I don't want to underestimate the significance of what she and the service has had to do. as a consequence of their understanding of what Congress wants to have happen. That's another issue that I'll deal with when we get to the discussions about the lawsuit. So those are the points I wanted to make about the closed area model and about our needing to be very concerned and careful not to take things out of context and to look at the mortality rates that now are in place in these fisheries and where we need to go. And percent reductions in exploitation aren't necessarily as nightmarish as they seem to be when we simply look at a table that shows what must be achieved.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Continue with what Dr. Pierce eloquently said, the other issue with southern New England is the blackback flounder, the southern New England mid-Atlantic stock of blackback flounder. And the requirement that the take of that be reduced by 100% or basically to zero catch. The thing that I find troubling about that is that on the GARM 3 report, page 2-462 and 2-463, it says the base VPA for the stock exhibited such a large retrospective pattern that the panel concluded it required an adjustment, and then they did the split time series adjustment, which reduced it but came nowhere near eliminating it. And it went on to say that the panel expressed concern about the uncertainties with the final run, in particular the persistent retrospective pattern that was not completely resolved by using the split in the survey time series. They then noted that the current biomass is extremely low and could remain so until recruitment improves. There are a number of problems here with closing fisheries based upon this kind of recommendation or this kind of conclusion. No one doubts about that the blackback flounder has been devastated, but it appears that M is particularly high with the blackback flounder, particularly in the juveniles. And I don't see, and it appears to be that the panel doesn't see either, how we're going to get any improvement merely by ending fishing on blackback flounder. Granted, that has to be done. We're probably going to have to be looking at it as some sort of zero possession limit. But we have a big problem with recruitment, and I don't think that's going to be improved until we straighten out the situation in Narragansett Bay, particularly Mount Hope Bay, the large breeding area for blackback flounder there that's been completely eliminated by the entrainment from the power plant. And also we have a problem with the bird predation on the blackback flounder throughout the bay. We have a huge cormorant population that's a fairly recent establishment, and they just love baby blackbacks. And it appears now that very few blackback flounder are being produced in the Narragansett Bay estuary. And I can't see the point to eliminating the southern New England ground fishery with all of the ancillary problems that Dr. Pierce pointed out and that Roddy pointed out, based on that kind of a statement. I think that if we look at the blackback flounder situation, it reminds me not so much of a fishery that's depleted by fishing, but more like the situation we have with halibut, with salmon. We still fish the waters that they're found in, recognizing the fact that they're heavily they're devastated fisheries. I think we need to approach the blackback flounder more on the basis that we do of fisheries like the halibut and the salmon, without thinking that by merely stopping fishing on them that we're going to get a recovery, because apparently the GARM 3 report doesn't believe that we will. It says biomass extremely low and remains so until recruitment improves. That to me weighs a big red flag. I think we need to take another approach with the blackback flounder. Thank you.
Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to vote for this motion as it's worded, but it seems futile to resubmit it back to the agency at this point, particularly bearing, particularly with the management measures that we have included. And we've all been trying to figure out a better way to do this and what the proper next steps are to move through as an interim rule into Amendment 16. I mean, a number of other folks have talked about the issues that are critical to me, the displacement of effort, the safety issues, the impact on the monkfish and the skate FMPs. But I think we need to underscore that this is an interim rule, and we have to address the GARM results, but we can't cripple the industry in the meantime. We're moving forward into Amendment 16. After some more discussion, I'm going to be prepared to make a motion to address some of the trip limits here and see if we can't move this ahead, slightly modified, back to the agency.
Anyone else in the council? Nope. Take some limited comments from the audience. Reggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich Canastra, New Bedford, Mass. What I mentioned this before as far as the channel flounders prior to Amendment 13. We at the auction used to do 3.5 million pounds a year. Amendment 13 came out with the reductions were about 1 million pounds a year. And that's been consistent over the last few years, 900,000. Million one. I have records to show it and to prove it. And that's like a two-thirds reduction since Amendment 13. But my question here, and the thing that I have a problem with, is that Georgia flounders, we went to trip limits. There was a problem with that stock. Yellowtail trip limits, haddock used to have a trip limit, cod trip limits. To go from one extreme to another, meaning that to close an area down, zero fishing without looking at a trip limit, it's just a radical decision. It's a radical decision that this stock wasn't in any type of problem prior to the GARM, and all of a sudden we got to shut it right down. It just doesn't make sense. My personal opinion on this interim rule was a broad brush stroke of putting the guys out of business. Let's get it done with, over with, because the analysis just doesn't make sense. When you're showing 31% reduction, it's actually 59. It just shows me that there wasn't a lot of thought process in it. And the other thing we had to realize too is that the 800 tons of sand dabs. I hope we can bring that up today. If there was any analysis there where that. Where that came from in the past of the 800 ton discard. Thanks.
Mr. Libby.
Gary Libby, Mid Coast Fishermen's Association, Port Clyde, Maine. My concerns with most of the comments I heard with the council, and it's the effort shift. So all the boats that are currently fishing southern New England, which will have no place to go, will end up in the Gulf of Maine where we fish, where it's already a stress stock, I'll say. And to add more pressure now would be like killing that area off and then putting a whole bunch of fishermen out of business. And I just was in hopes that maybe the council and the service could come up with some sort of relief so that folks could stay working, stay in business, try to get through this time of depleted fish stocks, because a lot of the stuff in the GARM 3, the way I read it, looked like there was a lot of recruitment there. And I think if we can get through this, we can have an industry again, and that shift in pressure, I think, would be the death blow of the whole thing. Thanks a lot.
Maggie.
Thank you. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. In September, Associated Fisheries of Maine supported the council's recommendation on the interim rule. And nobody should think that that interim rule, that particular recommendation that the council made, is not going to cause considerable harm to the existing fishing industry. The council's recommendation includes some very serious reductions in fishing mortality. And yet it does it in a way that hopefully some of us can make it to the end of 2009. To the great hope of what's proposed in Amendment 16. The Council's recommendation on the interim rule is totally consistent with the law for interim actions, and the Council should stand by that recommendation and send the message to the agency that you are the body that provides the recommendations on how to manage this fishery. And again, it's a recommendation that we endorsed reluctantly in September because of the harm that it will cause, but recognizing that some action must be taken in the interim, we supported it, and we continue to support it, and we urge you to simply send back that message that this is what you supported by a vote of 15-1 then, and continue to support today.
Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Just like to reinforce the concept of the Magnuson 304 E6 doesn't require to go to the level that this interim rule goes. Addressing overfishing was what the mandate would be under an interim rule. And the council plan that you put forward basically was expressing F rebuild on almost all stocks and FMSY and a couple. Was not promoting overfishing on anything. And I think the council needs to understand that from what we can tell, the service sort of dismissed the plan that you put forward by using the closed area model. And the plan itself that the council put forward was intentionally designed to not rely upon the closed area model. It was designed upon looking at the ACLs or the TACs, monitoring those TACs, and paying back overage if there was going to be any overage. It was intentionally designed not to rely upon the closed area model, yet the service, I think, mistakenly dismissed your plan by using the closed area model. We knew it wouldn't work under those for the reasons that Dr. Pierce and others have noticed. What we need to do is, if this fishery is willing to move forward and do catch monitoring like we're required to do in 2010, then the council plan works. And I think reinforcing that, like the Groundfish Committee did, is an important statement to make. We want to move forward into catch monitoring and more real-time counting of fish and accounting of fish during the fishing year and immediately following the fishing year. That's where we want to go. We want to get away from the CAM model type of analysis. So I don't, we definitely would not, we support the motion that's up there, and I would be very concerned about the council letting go of what they put forward and start talking about tweaking something that appears to have been analyzed in the old method of the CAM. So we support the committee recommendation.
Joel?
Thank you. I'd like to expand a little bit on what Mr. Preble was talking about with the cormorants and the flounders in this situation in southern New England. We've got a predation problem with the birds. We've got a predation problem with striped bass in the spring. We've got a predation problem with dogfish. Dave's absolutely right that, you know, predation is a primary reason for the stock to be so weak. We're pulling 6.5-inch cod ends around. You know, baby flounders are not going to be retained in this. But on a broader issue here, a lot of what we're dealing with, in my opinion, and a lot of the opinions of people in the industry, is it goes back to the leadership at NIMS. The leadership at NIMS has to take a step at some point, put their foot down, and get to the root problem of everything that we're dealing with. MSY in all fisheries is an impossibility. And someday, before I'm dead, I would love to see someone in a leadership role at NIMS send that message to Congress and say we need to change this law so we can stop having these ridiculous arguments all the time and wasting our time. We've got weak leadership, and that is the foundation of all our problems. When is the leadership at the National Marine Fisheries Service going to get up and put their foot down and say, this is impossible, we can't do it, and we're wasting our time? It's as simple as that. The people who are harvesting these fish deserve it from the people who are leading them. And what we have is poor leadership. Thank you.
John Auer.
Yeah, John Auer, Cape Cod, Get Fixed Gears Association. I agree with everything that's been said in this room today, and I would hate to see everybody get kicked out of the channel. We're coming up on year three for the Cape Cod 2-1 yellowtail rebuilding, just to see that get kicked out the door again with an effort shift. I mean, you know, I fished the 2-1 quite a bit. Don't see the big draggers anymore. They're all going to come back inshore for a place to fish, and you're going to take those 3 years of rebuilding and kick it out the door. And I'd also like, I know the agency is not answering any questions today, but I think the roundfish gill net fleet that's only allocated to set 50 roundfish nets a day that has caught less than 1% of channel flounders, winter flounders, whatever you want to call it today, should be kicked out of the channel, because it's going to be like the old times and the draggers are going to have to make a living, and I'm going to try to make a living, and I'm going to go out and pick up the pieces because they're going to have to do what they have to do to put a trip on the boat, and we're going to start losing gear again. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to take a break until 10 o'clock. I encourage people that want to caucus and come up with some thoughts on either the motion on the board or alterations to it to use this time wisely. Be back at 10. Okay, before the break, we had a motion on the board. I'll come back to the council and see if there's any further comments from council members. Vince.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. When the commission looked at Amendment 1 for winter flounder back in 2003, it was noted that we had, commission states, particularly New Jersey and New York, that aren't here and don't sit on this council, but historically they had recreational and commercial winter flounder fisheries that were in the millions of pounds. And granted, that was back in the 80s. When we took action in Amendment 1, the commission did get quite a bit of feedback about the fact that we did very little in Amendment 1 to do anything to the commercial fishery. And our rationale at the time was we were looking for mortality reductions from Amendment 13 from the council's plan. So as we're going forward at the commission with an addendum to look at winter flounder, there is this ongoing debate about the offshore mortality and the inability of the states to control that. So I just would like to bring that to the council's attention. Thanks.
Makes sense. Anyone else in the council? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just one quick point that I thought about it after someone in the audience, I got to the mic and addressed it, and that is, you know, at our last meeting when we discussed what the interim action should be, and we spent a considerable amount of time going over what the elements of that interim action should be. You know, we offered it up with an understanding that it would do quite a bit to reduce overfishing. And certainly the service has reflected on that that offering that we provided. And in the Federal Register announcement, the service concludes that our recommended alternative was insufficient to end overfishing. So I understand that's the service's position, but through an interim action, we're not obligated to do that. We're obligated to reduce overfishing. So that's what we are doing through this interim action. As a consequence of that, I do believe that we need to just reinforce this particular decision and perhaps, you know, back it up with some additional information that may be out there within our archives that would help to perhaps make the point even better than we made it in the initial submission.
Anyone else in the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Two. Abstentions?
Three opposed.
Three opposed. Abstentions, one. Motion carries 12-3 with one abstention. Anything further from the council under the interim action? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if we are going to move off of this. I did want to make one point really directed at the audience. We did have people come up and make comments on the interim action to us. I just wanted to restate to them that what we did here today was for the council. If you want to make official comments, you still need to make your comments to the service, as was indicated in the Federal Register.
Anything further under the interim action right now? Okay. We're going to spend around 45 minutes or so talking about the Framework 42 lawsuit. We had asked